Go ahead and call the regular and supplemental meetings to order. We'll recess the supplemental meeting. And the first thing we want to do is have a moment of silence for those members and pensioners who passed away. We also want to acknowledge two deaths of one in the fire department and one in the police department, Officer Burks. Obviously, that was a very tragic event the last couple of weeks. And you know, just learn more about him. It seems like he was an amazing man. And so that's probably tragic. It's always tragic for anyone, but particularly hearing about Officer Burks and his life story. So we can have a moment of silence for all of those not with us anymore. Thank you. First item we have are the minutes from the August 8th meeting. Do we have any comments or questions about those? If not, can we have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now we'd like to go to item D1. And give anyone here who's a visitor an opportunity to speak. Would anyone like to speak this morning?
Sure, I will.
Okay, we have, I guess, two people. Sure.
Just sit right here?
Yeah, just identify yourself. And
sure, no problem. My name is Chad West. I'm a member of the Dallas City Council. I represent District 1, which is north of Cliff. I'm in my fifth year on City Council. I'm here with a few of my council colleagues are here as well today. Last night, we voted to pass a pension plan to shore up the pension for the next 30 years, which we sent to the state legislature. Council will continue to do what we need to do to shore up the pension. We are committed to working with you. We ask that your board also works with us. Every time we need to shore up the pension, we're going to do it. It's our legal obligation. Our moral obligation. We're going to take care of our men and women who are taking care of us. But I will tell you, it hurts our ability to do other services in the city when, closing libraries, closing pools, not being able to give raises that we would like to be able to keep our employees, when we have to close gaps that this group, through its investments, have created. You look at the rate of return over the last 10 years, based on data that came in December, taking out the legacy projects that have been dragging you down, the rate of return is 5.5%, Austin is 6.4%, Houston is 8%, and San Antonio is 6.4%. So this fund is performing worse than all the other major cities in the state. This fund is dragging down the city's revenues. We're going to keep shoring it up, just like, I would. My kid that's going to be in college is not showing up to class and needs an extra fifth year. I'm going to pay for them to have it because I want them to be successful. So we will keep correcting the mistakes, but I would ask this board to do better with your investments. Pay careful attention to who's giving you that advice. Pay very careful attention to who's giving you advice on suing us, because we were completely prepared to do an extra payment, which we were in negotiations to do, and now we're in litigation, which makes our financial certainty uncertain. So whatever advice you're getting, I would scrutinize it very carefully. We are here today to listen and see how the sausage is made. With that being said, I do thank you for your service. I do look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. David, you raised your hand?
Mark, can tell you honestly.
Good morning, everyone. I want to echo some of that. I really thank each and every one of you for what you do for us here. I know it's not an easy task to do, but thank you for your service. I was asked after the briefing on September the 4th, the council was briefed on the proposal, and Channel 5 caught me as I was leaving there and asked to make some comments about my observations. As any of you who have done TV interviews know, you speak for 10 or 15 minutes and you make it 15 seconds. What shows up on television. But I made the comment for retirees, we feel like we're caught in the middle because, you know, the pension system may represent us. Retirees really don't have a voice at what goes on down. But yet we're the ones that have to live with the impacts of what happened. And that was the whole premise of my comment. I said retirees feel like we're caught in the middle. When somebody else refers to tell me, well, it's kind of like being a kid at home, you know, your parents fighting. And you don't know which one to support. And so really, if we're about to retire, we can't support. We just ask for y'all to work together and always keep the interest of the retirees at heart. Because some of the folks are really having a difficult time. 30% of their pension gone since they retired and not having any annual adjustment or whatever. That's all I wanted to say. I appreciate your work.
Thank you, David. Anyone else like to have an opportunity to say something?
Good morning. I'm Jaime Castro, president of the Dallas Police Association. Here representing nearly 3,000 members that we have with the Dallas Police Department. I don't know if all of you saw the council meeting yesterday. I was there to speak, and I'm here to do the same today. I'd like to start off by giving you a little background on the way I was raised. I was raised with three brothers, four boys total, and there was something that I learned from my parents. It was that it takes two to fight. It takes two to disagree. Not one. It takes two. As the president, I get the phone calls from everyone in disagreement around the department. And I'm here to let you know, I'm getting bombarded about the inner fighting with the city. You are our voice. Period. It ends right there. You represent us. Not the city. You all. You're elected and you're appointed to represent us. And when you're missing at the table because of decisions you all have taken, that is just flat out unacceptable. It's just flat out unacceptable. Because I have to be at the table with people like this agreement. You can ask them. We disagree, but I'm going to be at the table because I'm the voice for 3,000 members. So there is no way under my watch you're going to be missing at that table. You've had since 2017 to figure out who's going to make the recommendation. And you wait to the last minute to try to figure that out and get it settled. Unacceptable. It's unacceptable if, I get it, there's going to be differences, but not when it's going to remove you from the table. That's when it becomes unacceptable. So I'm here to let you know, you've got to get back to the table ASAP. We are at the deadline. And we're not going to have two parties missing at the table. Because I promise you, the associations will be there. The DPA will definitely will be there. But I'm not going to be sitting at the table twiddling my thumb while the pension is missing and the city's missing. That's just not going to happen. So I'm here to ask you to do whatever means necessary to get back to the table. That's up to you on how that's going to happen. That's why you're here, to figure that out. But you've had since 2017, and this is the best that can be put at the last minute? Unacceptable, period, across the board. There's nothing you're going to tell me that's going to convince me otherwise. This could have been done years ago, and it wasn't. But we're here. This is where we're at. Figure it out. And again, I'm here to let you know one last thing. The DPA will be making phone calls. We will follow up to see everything to ensure that you all are doing everything possible to get back to the negotiation table. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any comment? Great. Okay, I think it's great to see lots of people here and lots of engagement, and the views that you all express, you express with respect. So, you know, we appreciate it and welcome all of you to sit in today. That's great. Okay, so next we're going to go to item C1. Kelly, do you want to sort of tee it up?
Yes, thank you. The first item is titled Texas Government Code Section 802.1012 Actuarial Evaluation Audit. This is a state requirement. It's a requirement of the city to do this audit. So we have the guests here today, and I'll let you guys introduce yourselves in a moment. We also have Siegel. Jeff Williams is on the phone. Jeff will provide a formal response to the report, which is part of the laid out process in the law. This section of the code requires a plan sponsor, so the city, to engage an independent actuary to conduct an actuarial audit of the pension system every 5 years. The City of Dallas contracted with Deloitte Consulting, who is a retained actuary, to do this audit. Deloitte reviewed both the 1/1/23 actuarial evaluation and the 12/31/2019 experience study for the regular plan. The supplemental plan wasn't included as part of the process because it doesn't meet the size requirements to have that done. Both of these reports are dated, the 1/1/23 and the 2019, but it does fall within the timeline of the every 5 years, which is why those ones are the ones that are being reviewed. With that, I'll let Deloitte introduce themselves and talk about their findings and conclusions and recommendations.
Thank you, Kelly.
Sure.
Morning, everyone. My name is Jeannie Chen, and I'm here with Joe Kopnicki. From Deloitte, we're here to provide the results of our draft, a draft result of our review of based on Section 802. Oh, thank you. As required by state law. As Kelly has mentioned, you know, the Texas Government Code Section 802, you know, it requires this review to be done every 5 years, and it does lay out processes and specific timelines that we have to follow in the state code. So prior to our commencement of the audit, you know, we met with the funds as well as signed on confidentiality statements. And here today, we are providing you with the results of this draft review. And as you can see on the schedule, you know, with the first 30 days of completing our draft report, you know, we're required to submit this draft report to the pension fund, request formally in writing that the fund's actuaries provide us with a form of response that will accompany our report. And then within the 31st to 60th day of completing our draft report, we will be submitting a final report to the city, including the response from the fund's actuaries. We'll also be presenting the results of this review to City Council. And then ultimately, the city will be providing a copy of this report to the State Pension Review Board as required by the state code. Our approach to this review, you know, we are, as Kelly mentioned, we are reviewing the January 1st, 2023 actuarial evaluation report plus the most recent experience study and any assumption changes that have gone along since the last experience study. Yeah, and our approach really is to review the rationale and the thought process on setting the assumptions, as well as the completeness of the evaluation report to determine, you know, if they are done in accordance with actuarial standards of practice. And in general, our findings is that, you know, the findings is acceptable. All the assumptions and the report were done in accordance with standards of practice. And we can go through in more details in the next few slides on, you know, how we went about this review and the specific recommendations that we had to enhance the report and future studies.
Thanks. So this slide outlines what we looked at. We looked at the appropriateness of the assumptions and methods, the actually determined contribution and full funding year, looked at the valuation in light of the actuarial standards of practice, or ASOPs, and the completeness and consistency of the report and the communications within. We also reviewed test cases from the retained actuary, validating that the liabilities and normal costs within those appropriately reflected the plan provisions and the assumptions and the methods. For this review, we received the items at the bottom of the screen. We received both the raw data from DPFP as well as the final data from the actuary and looked at the reconciliation process between those two. We looked at the valuation report and experience study, the plan provisions, as well as the test as I mentioned earlier. As being said, the results that the 2023 valuation and 2019 experience study were performed in compliance with the ASOPs issued by the Actuarial Standards Board. The assumptions as of 2023 are consistent with the experience study. Several assumptions were updated since then. Oh, sorry. Yep. Several assumptions changed since the experience study, and we reviewed those as well. And all the plan provisions, methods, and assumptions are that from the sample lives we reviewed appear to be consistent. We did note some findings that can enhance the understanding and communications within the reports, as well as some considerations for the next experience study in developing the assumptions. The full list of findings is in the appendix, and as Kelly mentioned, the actuary will provide a response to that to include our final report. The next couple slides are just going to highlight a couple assumptions worth discussing now, and then the appendix has everything. So our findings were broken out into two categories. One, report content. This is the report itself, the communications, the calculations within the report, things like that. Just a couple findings to pull out from here. Consider disclosing the history of projected full funded year, which may enhance understanding of the plan's projected full funding history. This is an important metric, and it can jump around a bit year over year. So providing a historical schedule may give the reader more context for this metric. And then consider including a description of how closely current actual and target assets align with the targets used in the last experience study from 2019, which may improve the ability to validate the investment return assumption. Since the experience study is from 2019, just providing this would give the reader more context into how current assets may differ from the last time the actuary looked at the assumption, just for more context and how things may have changed since then. Moving on to the other category of our findings, which was related to the experience study and assumption development. So just a couple to pull out here. First, the investment return. We do believe the 6.5% assumption is reasonable, but worth revisiting. One, if 6.5 was at the low end of Siegel's range from the 2019 experience study, I think that range was 6.5 to 7.25. And two...
Can I interject for a second?
Yes.
In those situations, when you see six and a half and in the funds that have 6.5, doesn't that reflect the health of the fund and at our funding level, wouldn't that be appropriate?
There's a lot of factors that go into it, the asset allocation,
would you say the health of the fund would reflect that? I mean, when we reduced it, we couldn't be on par with everybody else because it had to reflect that. So when you look at funds that are at 6.5, is there something that there's a characteristic about them that requires them to be at that level?
They may have more conservative asset allocations, which could support a lower assumption. But
conservative being liquidity issues?
For example, if a fund is well-funded, they may be more in fixed income to protect surplus. And then they may have a lower assumption. That could be one example.
Thank you.
So since the experience study, the capital market assumptions have changed. It's been 3 or 4 years. The valuation report shows Siegel Marco Advisors capital market assumptions, and we applied those to the target allocations, the current targets, and that would yield 8.28% expected rate of return on an arithmetic basis. We did something similar with the JP Morgan publicly available capital market assumptions and got 8.15, so very similar. We also looked at the geometric return, which accounts for volatility and how that can dampen long-term returns in a portfolio. And that, at the bottom right, that would give 7.36 expected long-term return based on the current allocation.
Does Stegall have expected risk in their analysis?
Not in what they disclosed.
So how do you calculate a geometric return without risk?
The J.P. Morgan does have that covariance matrix in their publicly available report.
Okay. Quick question. Based on the environment that we have out there, I'm looking at that environment over the last 5 to 10 years, a majority of funds have gone from 8% down to the 6.5% level. Part of that is due to inflation. So taking a snapshot in time, the risk is that we'd be changing this at the wrong time.
That's a great point. And actually, the next slide shows the five-year history of the J.P. Morgan assumptions all applied to the current target allocation. And we do see a very wide range from 5.18 up to 7.36, the number from the prior slide, which does show that, you know, obviously from 22 to 23, fixed income returns went way up. That is affecting the J.P. Morgan assumption or their capital market assumptions. So, yeah, it over the past 5 years, there's been quite a wide range. So that is a fair point, that it certainly depends on the point in time that J.P. Morgan's published for what their return would be. Yes. And the below table shows the distribution of the 100 plans within Texas PRB. We do see about a quarter of them, 23, are at 6.5 or below. Majority of them are at 7 based on this graph. So all this to be said, you know, we do still feel the 6.5 is reasonable, but these various data points, as well as other data points, our finding is that the actuary and the DPFB consider these data points next time they look at the assumption, the next experience study is upcoming this year. Yes.
So what's the professional trigger or catalyst for calling something reasonable yet recommending you should revisit? I just found it incredibly interesting that was the only category that you all flagged. I mean, I looked at the other categories, inflation, payroll growth, salary increases, full adjustments, administrative expenses. And for whatever reason, you say that our number is reasonable, but you're recommending we should revisit it. What is the professional threshold that's met for Deloitte to say reasonable yet should revisit? And why did you not do that with any other category of assumption? Were there other assumptions where we were at the low end of reasonable or high end of reasonable? Why didn't you recommend we revisit those? That just really jumped out at me.
I mean, certainly all the assumptions have ranges, and we viewed this at the low end of the reasonable range, as did the experience study back from 4 years ago. And based on all these different data points, and these are some data points, and there's many different factors that go into this assumption, but our finding is just that it's worth revisiting, because there's a lot of...
I'm asking that we deal in objective measures in this world and some subjective overlay. What was the threshold that was crossed that caused Deloitte to say, in this one category, we're going to say that we should, you're recommending we should revisit, whereas in all the other categories, whether we're high or low, within the range of reasonability. You never said we should revisit anything. I read the report. I didn't see any other recommendations. But this one area that has a profound impact on what the liability is, your recommendation is that we should revisit it. So I wanted to know what threshold was crossed, what trigger was, whatever, to say that this is why Deloitte is saying reasonable yet should revisit. And they didn't say that about anything else.
I think in the full list of our findings, you know, those are all assumptions that need to be reviewed and revisited. This is one that we're discussing.
We just said what else needs to be revisited?
In the appendix, we provided a full list of our recommendations for the assumptions.
It seemed like disclose more, clarify. It was more in that category. I didn't see anything else that said revisit a fundamental core assumption. There was, flag it for me. What was there?
There were some for certainly the retirement and withdrawal assumptions.
Okay.
Different considerations to look at for the next study, and that's what this is.
This is on like page 3 or 4 of your presentation, and so I'm curious. I don't know that I've heard a good answer of why the recommendation here is to revisit. I mean, this is a big deal. This is a very serious thing. It involves the city. I mean, this really, when you say revisit, I take that very seriously. I just want to know what is reasonable yet revisit. I don't understand what threshold was crossed.
And this is definitely a metric that would change the ADC dramatically if we change that. So we want to be clear about what you're talking about.
So the investment return assumption is supposed to be a long-term forward-looking assumption because it's used to discount the liabilities and the benefit payment stream of the fund. We reviewed this and found it reasonable based on the documentation provided by your actuary, Siegel. In the experience study, they provided this range. You selected an assumption that is within that range, so it is a reasonable assumption. And then what we did in our review is to also use publicly available capital market assumptions, which JP Morgan, to assess whether this assumption that's selected is consistent with expectations of capital markets in the long term. As you can see, JP Morgan fluctuates year over year. So we don't have, we're not saying it should be X percentage, but here is the range it could possibly be in. And considering the direction that the capital market assumptions have been increasing since 2019. This is why we're stating that it's an assumption that should be reviewed due to just changes in the capital market since the experience study was performed in 2019.
So when you look at the next, that slide right there, would you say the trend is for pension funds to be increasing the discount rate, maintaining their discount rate, or lowering it based upon your work? Which of those three do you think would be generally most true?
In general, funds have been reducing the investment return assumption.
So your observation is that most are reducing. We're in the range of reasonability, but your one strong recommendation is we should revisit. That just strikes me as incredibly odd.
Is one of many recommendations. It's not.
It's the only recommendation you have in the front.
We just pulled out a couple that are worth discussing, but they're not ranked from top to bottom.
Well, in general, things you put in the front of a presentation and you say earlier have higher magnitude and you want to highlight and illustrate. That's just general the way, we all interact. I mean, please go on, but that really jumped out at me as an odd thing. I was thinking there had to be something I was missing. And I still think there's something I'm missing. I don't know what it is. But go ahead.
I mean, that's really all we have on the investment return.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, things.
Yeah, no, please, yeah. Please go on.
The other assumption that was recently updated was the salary increase assumption based on the recent meet and confer. 2023 is shown as well as the 2024 plus, the 3% or 2.5% aligns to the ultimate rates within the meet and confer agreement. Our finding is that the meet and confer specifically outlines a market-based compensation philosophy for future years, and that the next experience study specifically include a market-based assessment of those long-term rates, whether that 3 and 2.5 is best estimate of market-based pay philosophy based on other economic factors and or historical experience. If so, more support can be provided to justify that or more analysis in general to support the whole market-based environment that the fund is in. So with that, going through some next steps, as Jeannie outlines, the Section 802 is prescriptive as far as the dates and deadlines. So the Within 30 days of draft report, so September 27, we will need the response from DPSP, which will be included in our final reports. Then we have 30 days after that to submit the final reports to the city. And then after that, which is planned for November 7th, we will present to the Government Performance and Financial Management Committee on the findings for both the DPSP and ERF.
I had a question. Yesterday, the city adopted a plan. Did Deloitte consult on that plan, help the city prepare it, provide assistance? Any of those things?
We did.
Okay. Can you explain how the guardrails work?
The purpose of this meeting is related to the 802. Could we take that separately?
Sure.
I actually have a question on your opinion draft. Can we switch it up, flip to that page?
I don't believe
so. Okay.
We have the full report in here. John, it's page 29 of the Wikipedia. There
yeah.
you go.
Okay.
I don't know if you can highlight those.
This is your draft opinion?
Correct.
Okay. At the bottom, where you have the word employer, we're not aware of any relationship between the employee and the employer. It's not a defined term. Who's the employer? I looked up above for defined terms. I never saw. That's a critical statement about conflicts with the defined term that's never defined.
We can take that back and clarify that in our report.
Okay, yeah. Well, because I thought about it on the paragraph up above where it said our review is based upon information provided by DPSP and Siegel. I guess my question is that you all do a lot of work for the city, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did they weigh in or did you receive any input, data, opinions, anything from them and anything you formulated?
No, for purposes of this review, we received only the raw census file that the city sent to the fund, and then all the other information came from the fund.
Okay, so there's nothing about anything else that any input from the city or any. Okay, great. Okay. All right, well, if you could clarify who the employer is.
Sounds good. We'll do that.
All right.
And please let us know if there's any other changes or comments related to the draft so that we can also clarify it before we finalize our report.
I think Jeff will have some comments, right? Jeff
he
yeah.
will.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess from the following up on Nick's question, the legal requirement under the government code is that an independent actuary be hired by the city. It's clear that that independence is required of the city. Is that Deloitte's understanding?
The section code talks about an independent actuary, yes.
Yes, and so you're supposed to be independent of the city. Is that your understanding?
Independent of the fund or of the city?
Of the city.
Yeah. I like that.
So, do you understand why you were hired and under what statutory provision you were hired?
We were hired to perform reviews of the fund each year, including the Section 802 review.
Right. But what I'm asking you is, do you understand when Section 802 talks about independence, do you understand who you're supposed to be independent of?
The fund?
That sounds like a question versus a statement. Are you sure of that?
We believe we performed this review as an independent, as an audit.
But my question to you is, do you know with certainty, or do your lawyers know, or whoever it is at Deloitte that makes the determination that you are within the statutory provision, do you in fact understand who you're supposed to be independent of?
We can double check with legal.
So right now you issued a report, but you're not sure if you satisfy the statute.
We believe that we are an independent actuary for purposes of this review.
But you don't know who you're independent of or supposed to be independent of.
We provide consulting to the city, yes, but we are independent to the fund and to the city in relation to this review. We are applying our audit perspective for this and not you know, we're reviewing documentation received from the fund. It's not being swayed by any other work that was done.
But you may not be independent of the city in general, since you have, since Deloitte has provided services, since actuarial services since 2017, correct?
We have provided services. We can get back to you about the independence nature.
Yeah, I think so. I think we bear these issues, and, you know, we're, this is a big deal. This is, you know, as you hear everyone here, this is very serious. You know, all these things matter. They all fit into the big picture. So we know you all approach this with incredible professionalism and respect, but we have real questions, and we'd like some answers. And while something's in draft form, that's the time to flag these things for all of us. So we, you know, if there's nothing else, then I think you guys have some follow-up to do with us and with the city and clarify these issues.
I just have one comment. And I guess maybe in this issue of independence, would it be deemed how they're being paid? Like if they are regularly being paid and doing what's regular versus an independent kind of consultation that's outside the realm of what they're normally doing, would that be, I mean, if they are still on the payroll, then they're not independent? I mean, could you make that distinction just by money or how they're paid?
That's why I asked the question if they can help prepare the plan. Because I know if you just look at the city's website, the city's paid Deloitte $8.8 million, $8.8 million.
And they admitted that they helped with the plan already.
Right.
Okay.
I'm not an actuarial expert on independence. I think you have to look at the mosaic of all the facts and stuff to decide, is this group independent of this group?
Okay. Well, while things are in draft form, that's the time to air these issues. And they've been aired. Is there anything else anyone wants to say? Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. And I appreciate your, you know, coming here and presenting. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, next, Kelly, section 2.025.
Thank you.
Oops, sorry.
Thank you.
Good morning. I have actually a very short presentation today, which is kind of unusual on this subject, but since the board adopted a plan yesterday, the last meeting, and the city adopted a plan yesterday, I don't have a lot to tell you related to the plan that the board adopted. So my plan for this item is just to really let you know what has gone on since the last board meeting. So since the August board meeting, the city council adopted the ballot question and the ordinance for the ERF plan, the civilian plan. The changes to the civilian plan, which are in their ballot question, will remove the current cap on the city contributions to the ERF plan. The contribution percentage is limited for the first 5 years. It's a five-year step up. And then after that, there's no limit. Their ordinance also removes the requirements for employees to pay 37% of the total ADC, and it caps the ERF contributions. It doesn't set them at a number. It caps them so they can go down in the future. It makes no changes to the benefits, including the annual automatic COLAs that are granted to the ERF employees, which you know are based on CPI up to 5% for employees hired before 1/1/2017 and up to 3% for everyone hired since 2017 and everyone hired in the future. ERF employees have never had their benefits reduced. This is a slide that is a page that's taking off of a presentation that is included on the ERF website. It is their 2023 preliminary evaluation results from their consultants, from their actuary GRS, and I just have one slide of that presentation for you there. And what you can see, this is their unfunded actuarial accrued liability over time, and you can see it really is going up pretty steep in those out years. So
The blue line is based on the actuarial value. The red dots are based on the market value, and you can see the dollar amount of the unfunded liability in the bullet down below if you want to look at the dollar amounts. But just as a comparison, and this has not been talked about at all in the city council meetings, in the last 3 years, the ERF unfunded liability has gone up 82%. Meanwhile, the DPSP unfunded liability has gone up 8.5% during our last 3 years of reporting. So there's a very big difference. At least $175 million of the increase in those last 3 years are resulting from losses directly related to their COLA, and that's all coming from their valuation report. So I just wanted to show you that the unfunded liability for ERF is growing at a much higher percentage than our plan, but that's not being talked about.
Can you just talk about the differences between the blue line and the red dots? Because I think that's an important point, and I think some people don't understand that, so that would be great.
Right. So this is showing the blue line is the actuarial valuation numbers, and in the actuarial funded amount is a five-year smoothing. So there, 2022, most plans had losses. So there are losses that are not being reflected in those numbers in the blue line. The losses actually are being reflected in the red dots. So I prefer to always look at the red dots. So we've heard over and over and over that ERF is 73% funded. They were 73% funded on an actuarial basis a year or two ago, but they've been 67% funded on a market basis for the last 2 years. That doesn't get talked about.
Can you repeat that statistic you said earlier? Their liability has gone up what percentage over the past?
82% over the last 3 years.
And ours has gone up?
8.5, yes.
And yet this proposal that council is putting forward is going to take that cap off.
Yes. Yes, they've taken the cap off. They're doing nothing to their COLA, but apparently we're the problem, and ERF is not the problem. So I just wanted to show what they've done with ERF.
And just to highlight, and you know, in the last 7 years, they've had 27%
yes.
COLA adjustments,
yes.
And our retirees at zero. And so, you know, David, we think about that all the time, just from a core fairness issue. And that, you know, op-ed that we did, yeah, that was one of the main points, and not just fairness, but just, you know, livability for someone who is on a fixed pension, not getting Social Security, who retired with a certain amount, and now those are $0.70 with no adjustment. And that's, the core unfairness of it and just the economic reality of it are, I think, the two fundamental reasons why, you know, we adopted a plan, you know, with a much more modest COLA, why we feel so strongly about that.
So related to our plan, since the last meeting, there's been several difficult meetings, I'll say difficult to watch from our perspective. On August 22nd, there was an ad hoc pension committee meeting where Commerce Street presented their report. We were asked at the last minute to sit at the table, but not given an opportunity to really speak at that meeting. Mr. Wiley also presented his report to the full council on September 4th. It was similar to the first presentation. And then also on September 4th, the following item after the Commerce Street report, the city talked about the DPFP funding plan. We provided to you all both the videos and the transcripts from those meetings just so you can see the tenor of the meeting. And yesterday, the city did adopt a plan. The plan was different from the plan that they presented on September 4th. They removed the COLA. And the board adopted the plan.
Did they say why the COLA was being removed?
They indicated it was because of the lawsuit. They're mischaracterizing the nature of the lawsuit. So they say they can't do the COLA because of the lawsuit.
And because what is it, retaliatory? I mean, what's the point?
I would leave that to you.
Yeah, we don't have their
right.
point.
Could you clarify the lawsuit? Sure.
Who are unclear about what the purpose
sure.
of that lawsuit is.
So the lawsuit's pretty simple. It's basically asking the court to adjudicate the two different views of how Section 2.025 works. Our view is that the legislature enabled board to, in effect, change our statute to adjust benefits and contributions so that the plan would get to 30 years to fund. And if the legislature did not, was not happy with what the board did, it could change it in the 2025 session. The city's position is that this plan needs to be approved by not just you all, the board, but by the city as well. So it's a fundamental difference of opinion on how our plan works, and we are simply asking the court to say how that plan works, how that section of the plan works.
And we would, from the city standpoint, they'd want to know too, and
right.
that we get clarity on this. If we're misreading this, then we need to know, and then we can act accordingly. And if the city is misreading it, then I would assume they would act accordingly as well. So we think bringing clarity, and this is really about bringing clarity. It stinks that there's words, you use words like lawsuit. Yeah, that's technically
yeah.
a lawsuit. But really, and we would, I would think that people in the city would say, yeah, we want to know right away. Let's get court to rule as quickly as possible so that we know from a statutory standpoint what are the appropriate triggers for how the requirements of 30-year funding can actually occur. And so that's what this is about, is setting the guidelines, Riverbank's rules on how a plan, and the other important point is that it retains the force of law, that the 30-year funding stays within the box of a statute, and that it doesn't move outside that to just an agreement between two parties that can be changed over time. So those are really the fundamental things that we're trying to affect.
This is an eventuality. We were very close, but not an agreement, and it was always going to go down this road. It was just, I believe, just making it happen earlier so we can move on with the appropriate process.
And one other thing I think that I like to point out is even if the city agreed 100% on the exact same plan today, the way the city wanted to implement that plan that they would not budge on would make it so, as Nick said, could be changed at the will of the city. So there was no guarantees that would hold in place. So even if we're at the same place on the plan, the way they want to implement it and the way we think it needs to be implemented so the members can be assured that the funding is going to be there over time. They're just two different interpretations of the law, and that's what we're trying to settle.
So just to go back, I just want to clarify. The city approved their plan that was presented with the guardrails in place, but without any COLA at all. So the 1% COLA, one-time 1%, so 1% per year of base pay, that's not in it.
Not in there.
So there's zero COLA right now.
And it was said because we sued them.
Interesting.
So
the guardrails are there.
Yes. So I just wanted to point out some history that you all know, but what is getting picked up by the media is really big flashy stuff, right? We heard some of it this morning. Our investment returns are bad, so that's why the city's having to put more money in. We are being blamed for, I heard, libraries closing, pools closing, not being able to give raises. To put that in perspective, the city's proposed budget's $4.9 billion for next year for all funds, $1.9 billion for the general fund. The increase that's in this budget is the increase that they're talking about is $20 million. So it seems surprising that a $20 million increase is causing them not to have raises, close the pools and the libraries and
let's clarify,
all of that.
$20 million is their baseline no COLA versus our the COLA plan we adopted, and that's the difference in the annual contribution.
That's the that's the amount actually of the city with the 1% COLA.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So what we're hearing a lot of is big numbers. The plan's going to cost $11 billion because you take that and you put it over 30 years. So it seems to me all of these presentations are to blame DPFP for their budget challenges and their lack of planning, to justify not putting the COLA in for police and fire retirees, to try to gain control of the formula that will determine the city's contributions going forward, and to divert the attention away from the changes they're making to ERS. As a reminder, when HB 3158 passed in 2017, everybody knew, and all of the financial analysis that was associated with the bill from the legislature and everybody else showed that the funding level of the plan would go down over time, and it would take decades before it went up. You all have sat here for years. You've seen me every single year talk about the funding level going down, and it would continue to go down even if all assumptions were met. This is where we are. This is what was to be expected. The city knew this in 2017. In 2017, they needed more time to plan to put additional money in the budget, which is what brought us to this process we're in now for 2025. The city failed to plan for this, and now they're blaming us for that. We've provided actuarial valuation reports to the city every year. We've sent them letters saying the contributions that you're making are not enough to plan to fund the plan in 30 years. They paid a tremendous amount of money to Deloitte, their actuary, to review all this stuff and advise them year after year after year. The city had their own actuary on staff for several years. The city used to have a person from the controller's office come to all of these meetings. For many months, it was the controller herself. We post all of our investment information on the website. Every single month, we talk about investments. We talk about the private assets. We talk about how quickly we think the private assets are going to roll off. None of this should be a surprise. And it's really shocking that it is a surprise to the city, and I'm sorry about that. But this is not the fault of DPFP. We are where we are and where we expected to be in 2017. The DPFP board has been trying to be very responsible. Our assumptions might be on the reasonable side, but on the lower side, because we don't want surprises. We don't want to bait and switch. We want to make sure we can make all of our assumptions, and we're being criticized for that. So to me, it seems like it's all a bunch of manufacturing to put the blame on us, to get, you know, division within the membership, to get the members mad at us because they don't have a COLA. We are fighting for the members to get a reasonable COLA. The city is not. So I don't know why there's not more support for the COLA that DPFP is fighting hard to get for them. This pension plan is all that these members have. They do not have Social Security, and it seems that the city is choosing to play games with their presentations and the way they're framing this. And this impacts these members' lives for the rest of their life. And I think it needs to be taken seriously. It needs to be presented fairly. And I would hope that we could get to a place where we all agree on a plan, but that the way that has to happen is that it needs to be something that's binding. It can't be something that the city can do voluntarily, that they can change it at their will. So this is where we are.
Yeah. So since 2017, the notion that we've waited to the 11th hour, I just want to dispel that notion that this is at the last minute we're coming up with a solution we've had since 2017. And by the way, most of the board members on sitting here weren't even here in 2017. A lot of us have been on the board for just a couple of years and have very strong financial backgrounds and have tried to be very responsible about where the plan moves forward from here. So the sound bites that are disseminated about the irresponsibility of this board and what the board is thinking, I assure you there are very capable people on this board that were not present during the time that many of these investments were made that got this plan to where it is. Unfortunately, we're now having to solve the issue. But to clarify, since 2017 and now, what have been the steps that the board and the city have taken, or what has been the awareness about the need to come to this point?
Since 2017, well, first of all, the city knew about the Section 2.025 when the bill was passed, so they knew the process we would be going through now. But every year since 2017, we have provided an actuarial valuation to the city, and in that valuation, there was a dollar amount that said, this is what your contributions would be to fund this plan in 30 years. I've had conversations with the former CFO about putting more money into the plan, and she said, no, we're only putting in the required amount to the plan. So we have provided year after year after year the amount of money that would need to be put in place. It's not surprising. What is surprising to me is, well, last year, actually, the city budgeted to put in their budget, I think it was $15 million extra, but that got cut out. But when they did their budget last year, they always do the current year budget and the planning year. I have no idea why in the 2025 planning year, or the year they're doing now, they didn't put in more contributions. They knew this was coming. It just illustrates the lack of planning.
The most important fact, I think, in my view, is the people that were just here, you heard Jeannie acknowledge that they've been advising the city since 2017, actuaries. They've been advising the city, getting our reports, reviewing things. They're fully qualified to see where the funding level is going and what's going to happen. They fully understood how Section 2025 worked and the fact that this day was coming. So we have no idea what they were telling the city, whether it's the city staff, whether it's the council. We have no idea what that communication flow is. But for sure, if you're the city and you hire a qualified actuary firm to help you, and to say for the city then say, wow, we didn't even know this was going to happen. I mean, someone's at fault there. Someone over there.
They also immediately said that the majority of pensions in Texas were reducing their assumption rates. That, in effect, means that the liabilities for the respective other side is going to grow. So, I mean, people were in trouble, and everyone knew this was happening. I've been here since the beginning. We have made concerted efforts that day. Well, only monies that were only given to deploy for benefits. No money extra was ever given for the unfunded liabilities. What came in went out. That was it.
I'm just kind of curious. So everybody in here, except for Matt and I, were appointed by the mayor of the city. What was the makeup? I just want to clarify this. The makeup of the board before 2017 was there were city council members who were actually on the board, correct?
There was four city council members.
Four city council members.
Police and fire.
Okay. Yep. So when I hear from meetings where they're saying that the board stole money or this money was stolen out of the plan, there it's kind of us versus them or whatever, but there were four city council members on the board that stole the money. I mean, so the board back then included the city on the board. They had a direct say in what was going on at that time. And nobody else in this room, except for I think two people who were not were here at that time. So I just want to clarify that when I hear rhetoric like that, it's a little disingenuous.
Here's what I would say. One time someone negotiating said to me, even the thinnest pancake has two sides to it. You know, we're, I think, in a classic situation where there are tons of needs and limited resources. And I view this as just kind of a traditional process of working through that, where there's going to be lots of noise and certain perspectives on things that we would really like to come to common ground with the city. But oftentimes you need catalysts for that to occur. And you know, what I view there is, you know, one of the catalysts will be what the court says. And once again, I don't ever want to speak for anyone else. I would think the city would want to know just as much as we want to know the certainty and quickly as possible So anything they would do that would delay court decisions seems odd to me, because I would think they would want clarity like we want clarity. Like, if we're misinterpreting it, I want to know right away. And I would think the city would want to know that too. The other things that we feel very, very strongly about is that whatever we agree with has to retain the force of law. It has to still live within the statute. It can't move outside the statute, because it becomes weaker in terms of it being certain going forward. That being said, the city has made some requests on some things they would like to sort of weigh in on, and you know, we're willing to talk through that, but it has to retain the force of law. And then I think we're in agreement on the ADC concept. We have sort of a 3 or 5 year sort of bid ask on that with the phase in. But then the other thing is there has to be some sort of an equal COLA, because we live in an inflationary world and there's every reason to believe that will continue. And it's just, as I said a few minutes ago, grossly unfair to have city employees versus first responders with a significant COLA versus no COLA. And then there's just the livability of a reduced amount. And I think that we all have felt very strongly about those issues. And to the extent we continue to sort of work down that path, there's lots of noise and so on. And, you know, Tori Wiley says this, and city council people see that. And I'm sure the city council people are hearing us say things that they, you know, inflame them. And that's just the way it is in the process. And, you know, we hope to sort of work through it. And if we can't, then it'll go to the state legislature, and there will be people that are elected state officials that have very little to do with the city of Dallas that will be weighing in heavily on the outcome. And I ideally wouldn't want that to happen, but we both have to know that that's where this could end up. And so given those impulses, hopefully we can find common ground somehow, some way. It's hard to see how that will happen today, but I'm very optimistic that it will.
When I think back about how we were negotiating and what kind of like was one of the factors that muddied the water, I am going to say that it was when the council decided to get Commerce Street, Dory Wiley, Mr. Wiley involved. And I wanted to be clear, now that you have council, especially with, you know, Councilman Chad West saying something about, very poignantly say, who is giving you advice? I throw that back at you. Do you realize who is giving you advice? I have said repeatedly, that I am not against you guys getting an independent, impartial investment advisor, but I was very clear that the person had to be impartial and that the person had to be qualified, and it would not impede the progress of what we were doing as far as negotiations went. Mr. Wiley is neither impartial nor is he qualified. He has never worked with a pension fund. He has never worked for a pension fund, and he's never been hired to do this. When the stakes are so high, why would you choose someone when there is a plethora of pension investment advisors? Where I can rattle off 10 right now, you would choose someone that is very well aligned with a council person from previous years and is saying things. If you don't believe that he's not qualified, I'm going next month in New York and taking that transcript of what transpired in the last council meeting to show the challenges that boards and investment committees and pensions have with the politics behind it. Because I have to be honest with you, I am absolutely all for a qualified investment advisor that's in your camp that would help you as non-financial professionals to understand the arcane math that is pensions. But when you bring in someone who does this folksy kind of football and this and that and dogs and we're going to bite and you got a poker hand and he's doing all that, he's not talking about the true essence. He looks like he blew off the dust of a 1999 financial textbook and talks about like risk-adjusted returns and allocations. These things are not going to solve what the problem was. He doesn't say anything substantive about our business and what we've done. I know I have to be careful because, you know, I would love for, we have asked repeatedly for Mr. Wiley to come and present in front of this board and the investment committee, and he has not. It's been refusal, refusal, and asking permission from Jack Ireland to come, and he has not come. We predicated working with him so that we would have a rebuttal and we would be able to talk to him. He has not. He has says we have not. That is not true. So since he's been involved, we've been hearing things like we're not doing a good job, and private, his last discussion was 50 times talking about private equity, which, by the way, is alternatives, and it could be private equity, private credit, real estate, or whatever. He just, these are platitudes. They don't say or mean anything. And I'm not sure why he was chosen when the stakes were so high. And you need to really understand what we're doing.
Tom.
Yeah, just for the record, I would mirror the comments that Bettina's just made. And as the past chief investment officer for the Employee E-commerce System of Texas, that was a report that really had a lot to be desired, bottom line, period.
Yeah. At the same time, the city can do what they do. I'm sure they object to some things that we would do. And, you know, we've cooperated. Your comments stand on their own, but you know, we respect the city's right to engage with whatever advisor, and we've cooperated. So, but like I said, I think that, you know, we should stay on our true north, which is the outcome we want, that this retains the force of law. We get an ADC, we get a real and meaningful COLA, and we move forward. That's what we want to accomplish, and everything else is ancillary to that. Kelly, anything else on 2.025?
No.
Okay. All right.
Brenda.
All right, Brenda, financial audit.
Good morning, everyone. As I reported at our last meeting, we have received all of the financial information that we needed to complete our financial statements and forward them on to the actuary. The actuary is working on the new report. We expect to be able to present that new report to you in October. Once that report has been presented to you, the following month in November, our audited financial statements, as well as the annual comprehensive financial report, will be presented to you in November. The staff is continuing to work on the pieces of the annual, the audited financial statements, as well as the ACFR that we can while we await the actuary report. Are there any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Dates or
October for the actuary report, November for the audited financials and the ACFR.
Okay. Kelly. Ministerial actions.
Yeah, so this is your monthly report on the activities related to the pension system as far as benefits go. So you'll see that refunds had a large tick up, and I'd like to acknowledge Kimberly Boone for that. So she's been working on a project to contact people that have left their money here a long time ago, trying to get the money back to the people. They don't have a pension benefit because they weren't vested. And it's not earning interest, and it's really hard to contact these people. So she's made 11 of these refunds were actually these old refunds. So she's doing a great job with that. That's why you see the tick up there. It's not more people left the city. Estate payments were a little bit higher, which that comes and goes. Retirements were down. There were only 7 retirements in August versus usually an average around 10. So that's good, and nothing else is unusual. Questions about that?
Monthly contribution report.
This report is, nothing unusual about this report. There were 3 pay periods in this month, which this reports the data for July, and everything is on track. The city actually was over their hiring plan by 75 employees during the last payroll of July, so that's good. Hopefully that will continue.
We're going to have to increase those access when the city starts those higher contributions. We'll have to get the new formatting done. So
we can do that.
Get ready for that.
Okay. The next item is also a standard item. It's just a listing of the board approval of trustee education and travel. We've got classes listed for you here. These are the NCPR classes. Again, I would highly recommend the public safety conference. It's always a good one. I've also attended the accredited fiduciary. That's good as well. I've not done the HR summit. I wouldn't probably recommend that one. But the other ones, if anybody is interested in attending, let us know, and we can have the board authorize that. Anybody?
And we all had our required training. We've been nudged on, so everyone.
Yeah. Right. I finished mine as well. Okay, the next item is the professional services committee meeting, which met this morning. Is Steve on the phone, John?
He's not. This is Mark Knob. I'm supposed to speak on his behalf on it.
Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, the Professional Services Committee met with Makita at 8 o'clock this morning. It was a productive meeting. No red flags or concerns. I think they spoke very well of staff. If there are any questions, please let me know.
So just to, for people that aren't aware, the board adopted a policy, I think, maybe 2016, our board and the current board is continuing it, that on an annual basis, a committee of the board meets with the professional services people, which are the investment consultant, the actuary, the fiduciary counsel, and then they do a similar thing with the audit committee. And the purpose of these meetings are to get unfiltered advice from the professionals without staff in the room. So that way the board can be sure that any information or recommendations that the professionals are providing staff are not being filtered. They can say what they want to the board members, and we think that that's worked well. So that's the point of this committee for those of you who have. All right. And Michael, if you could talk about the class you did attend.
I went to TechSPERS in San Antonio, and I thought it was outstanding. I would definitely recommend going back. I thought it was much more informative than the previous conferences they had in Dallas, where I thought you kind of had half and half good information and kind of fails, if you want to say that. I thought I got a lot out of this, and just kind of understanding private lending a little more. And just, I thought overall the speakers and the presentations were outstanding. And I was there, and they all, the people at the conference kind of said, yes, this is much more informative. So I was very impressed and got a lot out of it. It's one of the better conferences that I've attended over the last 10 years. As far as information available and kind of getting a bigger picture on where the economy is going and how that affects that attention.
Got it. Super. Okay. All right, Ryan.
Thank you, Nick.
Portfolio update.
For investment agenda items today, I'll go through the portfolio update. Tom will talk about the IAC meeting that was held late August. And then we're going to do an asset allocation update, and then McKee will be here to go through the performance report. Starting with the portfolio update, estimated year-to-date returns for August is 7.8% for the overall portfolio and 11.8% for the public portfolio ex cash, which is now 75% of the portfolio. As always, the liquidation of the private market portfolio is a top focus for us. We've gotten, with the distribution that we received yesterday at a Lone Star CRA fund, we're up to $55 million year-to-date. $36 million came out of that sale. That's the biggest distribution we've had in the private portfolio since 2021. It's credit to the company and the GP for performing, but I think it's a direct result of the work we've done since 2017, 2018, working with this GP, being in the trenches and exerting our rights as LP to maximize proceeds and ensure money.
If we were to look at Lone Star since inception today, it's a negative IRR, right?
Lone Star CRA is a positive.
Okay, but just overall Lone Star?
Yeah, the suite of funds is negative.
And so when we talk about the salvage operation, this is spot on what we're referring to, where due to efforts, we could have basically written this off, sold it for a penny on the dollar, and then had very clean returns from the point at which we did that. We thought that was not the right thing to do. Instead, we've had to sort of grind on this. It's been very, very difficult working through it. But in this case, we had proceeds of $36 million, which covers our shortfall on contributions versus benefits for about
4 months.
4 months?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when we talk about the salvage operation that dilutes and reduces returns, reported returns, this is specifically the type of thing that we're referring to, and this is a great example of that. So,
I would like to also say something too. This, I have been here since 2017, and if you told me back then, and I've been through it with 7 years, that we would have gotten any money out of Lone Star, I would have never believed you. This is like squeezing water out of a rock. I mean, litigation after, I mean, the whole thing, it was just painful. And while we've had turnover with boards, it's been the same pain each and every time as they've each relived it. But I also want to thank Michael as well, because I know you've worked closely with staff, and this is another great example of the collaboration that happens between board and staff to get these things done. And I thank you as well, along with Ryan and all y'all. So thank you. This is a huge win. I'm very excited about that, more than any other distribution. I mean, money we've received out of these.
No, I've been hearing about the sale of this company for 5 years now.
So. Like, beyond. This one has been a particular, I actually kind of wrote it off as a zombie for a long time, but it's not. It has something.
I just want to say it goes back to the benefit of the expertise of a board member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%.
In the financial industry, which very unfortunately was not the case in 2017 or before that. So there has been some changes on the qualifications that board members bring to the plan. And so this is an example of why it's important to have those expertise.
Yeah, the other thing is that the valuation was significantly higher than what we expected.
Yeah.
You know, for several years, what we would be able to realize it. So it was a very good result also in terms of valuation. So.
And logistics. I also appreciate the due diligence that you made sure that the monies were in a third party. That was very, very instrumental in making sure that we received those monies. I think that was really important as well.
All right.
Good job, Ryan.
Thank you. With that sale, we're close to $1.5 billion in proceeds from their private markets portfolio since 2017. So talking about the salvage operation, we've made a lot of progress there. On the custodian switch, board approved hiring BNY as a new custodian in July.
Great.
We're working towards a year-end transition date from JP Morgan to BNY, so there's a lot of onboarding work that we're having bi-weekly calls with them right now that'll step up to weekly as we get closer.
Does the switch just turn on and off from you to switch one to the other?
I mean, there's a lot of switches to turn on and off.
Oh, okay.
Ultimately, it'll be one switch that moves everything over.
One more comment. Now with this last distribution from Lone Star,
with this most recent.
Most recent, sorry.
There'll be more coming.
Yes, hopefully. So where are we with the with our
We were about 23% with that sale. We're about $445 million remaining. So probably down to like 21%. That was 1.3% of the portfolio. So the overall privates are about 21%.
Liquid? Really?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, good. Very good.
All right, rebalancing, we updated you last month, but in July we pulled $17 million from public equity to restore the safety reserve, which is a cash and short-term bond allocation. Looking forward on investment initiatives, we have a discussion today on asset allocation and what to do with the other private equity, Huff. We are working through kind of initial onboarding with Allborn, which is a new private markets consultant. They presented to the IAC last month. We expect in October we'll bring the formal asset allocation study and recommendation to the board. And then following that, we have some investment policy statement updates to make based on the new asset allocation. So typically here we have some market charts to go through, but given kind of all the discussions about our portfolio and returns, I thought it'd be useful to go through, especially with some new board members, some of the history that leads into that 10-year return number that's been talked so much about and how we, you know, how that shakes out. So the prior board, this is looking at private market commitments per year going from 2000 to 2016. So 2016 was the last year we made a private market investment. If you look at the 05 to 08 timeframe, $1.9 billion of capital was committed to private equity infrastructure, direct real estate. So they went on a buying spree in that time frame.
What year was Lone Star? What year was Hop? Since those are the two big.
Hop was 2006. That was a $100 million commitment. Lone Star was $50 million in 2008. So it was a combination of real estate, private equity, and other direct investments.
And I think you have made this comment, too, that that portion before basically shows the cadence in which you enter into private equity. Like, it's not like you go in full force. You kind of step into it.
Pacing.
When you see that level and you see these, this is kind of like bank loans and leverage being applied to getting into this space.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of real estate was kind of driven by this loan program, and it, obviously proper vintage year pacing would not allow this to happen. A lot of investments, 05, 06, kind of in that time period, a lot of the real estate and private equity was not properly valued. A lot of it was probably bought at too high of a price, and then in 2014 when Kelly came in and our new CFO, predating that a little bit, we started a process to revalue all the real estate assets in the portfolio, stuff that probably should have been marked down in 09, 010, and was probably, you know, a price that was too high when they bought it. So we had significant write-downs on that private markets portfolio in 15, 16, again in 18. So when you look at that 10-year period on the 10-year return, we're capturing write-downs on investments that were made in 05, 06, that should have been written down before that, that weren't marked down until 15. So when we talk about the drag from the legacy portfolio, that's really what we mean with the decisions that were made, you know, way back when, still bleeding into the 10-year return number and the 5-year number.
And one quick comment. It's often been said that why didn't we go into the secondary markets to get rid of some of these properties? And unfortunately, the secondary market really wasn't in major existence at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
It was just in its infancy. And fast forward today, the secondary market, unfortunately, people can smell the blood in the street, and they will give you discounts of anywhere from 20% or less on what, you know, if you just work it through, you'll get a much better realization.
And we did go to the secondary market in 16 and sold 26 funds. We sold direct investments in toll roads. So this new board came in 17, and we had what was left in the private equity portfolio, and a lot of the, you know, more well-performing private equity was sold in that time frame.
One of the criticisms in the last thing was this idea that 7 years, you have 7 years. Well, you know, I know that there is no bid markets, but then this idea of bid and offer in an open market kind of stocks and equities kind of concept. The idea about private equity and private in general and alt is this, that we are LPs to a GP, and the GP gets to decide when that happens.
And there are things like zombie funds where they capture your capital and do nothing and do give you nothing but cost you in some instances. And this idea that we should own them or we should get rid of them is just kind of elementary or just in a, not a statement that you would use in this asset class, I would believe.
Agree.
LP meaning limited
partner. Oh, yes. Limited partner versus, yeah.
Limited partner.
As a limited partner, yes. A lot of these.
One of many limited partners, so we can't call the shots.
Right. So if the GP, the general partner, doesn't want to do anything, we cannot do anything.
And I mean, I believe a lot of secondary series require the GP to have transparency to a buyer to come in to look at the assets to make a bid.
Right.
Which was not the case with some of the private equity that we had.
Right.
So Kyle put together this chart. It's looking at the blue line is our rolling 10-year return of the overall plan, including the legacy assets. I think in Makita's report, it's at 2.3%. But this is looking at kind of what happens to that 10-year return as those write-downs in 15, 16 drop off the history. So the orange bar at the bottom is even if the plan returns 0% for the next 2 years, that 2.3% would jump up to just above 4. If we earn the 6.5, that 2.3% return would jump up to just above 5%, probably 5.25. So I think it shows when we talk about a 10-year period, we need to think about the 10 years that are included in that 10-year period and what happened there. Any other questions on this analysis or the legacy history?
The 10-year return is our return. We have we're not saying we're not trying to distance ourselves from it, but we're trying to bring clarity to it that it has a complicated set of components to it.
Right.
It has this legacy salvage operation side to it, which is a drag on returns. And then we have another side that looks and acts like a pension fund should, that we think has produced good returns, and we have, you know, Makita here who advises us and a competent investment staff, but we don't want anyone to think that we're trying to distance ourselves, that we're going to play a pronoun game, and you say that's you or them or whatever. It's us, and that is, this is our legacy. We own the legacy, and we're dealing with it in terms of what's the best path forward. But we do think it makes sense, and even later when we, I want to mention the safety reserve, because that's yet another thing where we have an allocation, the short-term cash we call safety reserve, and we have to do that because of our mismatch in outpayments versus money in. If we were funded 80, 90%, we wouldn't have a safety reserve. And instead, that 9% would be perhaps in private equity, compounding at, according to these estimates, you know, 10-12% per year. Instead, we have to keep it in cash because we don't, if we have down markets, we don't want to have to sell stocks and bonds at depressed prices, so we have this thing called a safety reserve. And so we've had to push various dials and buttons to do what we think is appropriate, once again, protect from the downside. But it's the reality of it, and the diluted returns from the safety reserve, the diluted returns from historical legacy private investments, that's all part of our return. We own it, but we want everyone to understand and have clarity around the components because we do believe they're a little more complicated than in most normal pension situations.
Yeah.
A little bit of context on the 10-year return number that was mentioned earlier, ex-private market, lagging some other plans. What I would say about that is the other plans that we're being compared to had the benefit of good private assets in the portfolio. So we're looking at just our stocks and bonds compared to their entire portfolio. And also, you guys know, the private assets were 2/3 of the portfolio in 16. So as we built back out that public side of the portfolio, we started with the most, we had a lot of risky assets on the private side. So we built out the fixed income and the least risky portions of that portfolio first. So the mix between stocks and bonds was not what it is now, where we have about 75% of the public in equities and 25% in fixed income.
When you're getting these Okay, I'm sorry. Just continue.
Come back to it.
I'm curious. I'm taking it out of context, but I was just saying, when you get these now distributions, or are we full in our reserve? And will it?
He'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're full in the reserve right now.
Yeah.
Let me skip that slide for now. This is a snapshot of our public market performance. As I mentioned earlier, up 11.8% year to date, and 8% over the 5-year period. Just a few managers to point out. Makita's got their more full performance evaluation later, but Eastern Shore of the U.S. small cap is performing well year to date, up 13.5 compared to the benchmark at 10. On the equity side, it's good. On the EM, obviously the returns there have not been great over any time period, but the RBC offers quite a bit of downside protection, and you can see that in the 3-year return, where the index is down 2.3%, and they are just slightly positive. And then, as typical, quite a bit of green across our fixed income page, where our managers are performing well there. Ended the month at $2.03 billion. In AUM, with $150 million this year from investment gain and other income, and $63 million going out to pay benefit payments net. We talked about this earlier, but this chart would look a little bit different with the Lone Star included in there. But over the last 6 years, the inflows from the private asset portfolio covered 95% of the net benefit outflow, so the $10 million a month, or $9 million a month that walks out the door.
Yeah. And once again, being redundant, but we cannot stress how critical this has been for the functioning of the last couple of years. If we had not had this occur, if we had written off and sold everything for a penny or two on the dollar, then we would have had to sell pieces of the public portfolio that have been compounding at good rates of return in order to cover this cash shortfall. A big factor in this cash shortfall is just the ratio of people paying into the system versus the number of beneficiaries. That's just a structural issue, which is related to investment returns, but also stands separate from that. So this, and this is something that staff from other public pensions doesn't know how to do. I mean, this is truly an ancillary set of skills and tasks of monetizing private assets. This is what traders at Goldman Sachs do. This isn't what people who run investment portfolios at public pension funds do. So staff has done a really good job on this. You know, all the people here who have good investment experience have been very impressed with how staff's performed in this area, albeit this has been a huge detractor on the return. So when you look at the 2-2, 2-3, 10-year return, this has helped contribute to that in a significant way, but it's been absolutely critical from a liquidity standpoint for it to occur.
Nick, so this is our safety reserve dashboard, looking at how much we have in that cash and short-term bond portfolio compared to our target. So we're end of the month at $180 million versus the target of $183. Net benefit outflows have been averaged $8.6 million per month, so that safety reserve of $180 would cover monthly outflows for the next 21 months or through June of 2026. We have about $1.5 billion and a little bit over $1.5 in liquid assets right now. So we have a safe reserve and then the rest of the liquid portfolio off of that. Asset allocation detail, not a ton to go into here. I guess this would probably help just the next discussion on asset allocation. But when you look at the global equity portfolio, you can see all the managers listed down below that, where we have an asset class, global equity, and managers to implement that asset allocation. We're talking about, with asset allocation, creating some more broad asset classes that combine global equity and EM equity into one asset class, and then down below on the bank loans, high yield, and EM debt portions of the portfolio, we'll be recommending in October to combine those into one public credit allocation. So I think this is just a good depiction of how the asset allocation looks and what is a manager target versus a asset class target. With that, I think it's Omnic to give a report on the investment or IAC meeting from Omnic.
Sure. Good meeting, great attendance, and bottom line factors were one, we had Auburn, as was mentioned, present a private credit overview. And it was interesting in the sense that they covered all the pieces in terms of private lending, distressed, real asset, real estate debt, structured debt, and specialty finance, and how these pieces all work together. With that, the discussion was to put together a roadmap to private credit deployment. We'll call this design phase fourth quarter 2024, which would require a modification of the investment policy statement, establish asset guidelines, pacing study, as well as an evaluation, due diligence, selection phase, and execution and final monitoring. So putting a lot of meat behind the process. Beyond that, we had Makeda present emerging market debt overview and pros and cons. Pros, definitely growth, technological advancement, productivity, better demographics, lower equity valuations, diversification benefits, and the fact that emerging market debt bonds can and do offer a generous yield premium to, the developed countries. The other point to mention, and it was mentioned earlier, the emerging markets has been challenged more recently. Emerging markets tend to go through a process of different phases, and for the last number of years, they've been under pressure due to inflation, due to political events, and the like. The 10 years part of that, they were very competitive, and it's not a one-stop shop. It provides diversification to the overall portfolio. The negatives for emerging market debt is really sector country concentration. You do tend to get a little more volatility. It can be cyclical. You do have a currency effect, some of which you can hedge, but most of which you can't. And you do have event and political risk. So something to be reviewed and talked about and looked at going forward. Then we had an asset allocation study of allocation mixes for consideration, liquidity analysis, and rationale by Bacata. The takeaways were really, one, update the investment policy statement, which is on the agenda going forward, and to include some asset class structured language as well. Also, our thought was to separate the legacy assets into different composites from the new private markets in Auburn's performance reporting. Some of these refinements could be combined EM equity, which is 4%, with global equity, 54% for public equity, which would be 58%. Combine high yield, bank loans, emerging market debt into a new private or public credit allocation, be about 11%, and also continue to maintain safety reserves at 9%. So a lot of words. Bottom line, the objective would be for future discussion with the board direction, when and how best to initiate a new private equity investment, given the over-allocation issue caused by HUF. Approval of asset allocation changes. Updating the investment policy statement, as well as providing possibly more meat in the investment policy statement, as well as other, as far as asset classes and what we do, what we want, and how it's to be paced through. That, we adjourn right on time and open for questions.
The only thing I wanted to add to that, to the investment committee, is that the selection of Auburn was very purposeful. There was a process there. There were other firms considered, and Auburn was selected because they have a particular expertise in the private asset space. It is a very thoughtful approach to kind of take a long process in getting ready to decide on the appropriate private equity allocation going forward. I think it is incredibly prudent of the investment committee and the trustees in providing a thoughtful approach of how we re-enter based on the mistakes that were made in the past to make sure that those don't occur And even though Nikita is incredibly capable in the private space as well, we made a conscious decision to hire separately our advisor whose expertise is particularly in the private.
Yeah, just add to Michael's comments. Allborn is a world-class leader in terms of due diligence, and they've done this for a number of years. And this is an extension of staff, but it also provides a lot of capability and credibility and also information that takes years to develop if we were to try and duplicate that. So it really is an asset at the end of the day. Any other questions?
Tom? All right, so we'll get into some of this asset allocation discussion that we had at the IAC. So here's the timeline. It's been a long timeline on our asset allocation study. It started back in January with Makita coming up with their asset allocation assumptions for each asset class. We had initial discussions in March on mixes to review, and this has been us working hand-in-hand with Makita on the asset allocation for the overall portfolio. We had some concepts in March, and we brought those back to the IAC in August. I think we're pretty set on what we want to recommend to the board in October, but there's this one last piece that we want to discuss on the private equity allocation that will be coming up next. And then we would, just timing-wise, we have another IAC in September, so we'd kind of bring the board feedback to the IAC and then plan to bring the final asset allocation to the board in October. So it's been a long process, but we're in no rush on this. I think it makes more sense from a reporting standpoint to have everything go effective 1/1/25 anyways. So Tom mentioned this, but this is a look at the key changes that we're talking about making to the asset allocation. First would be a new 4% allocation to private credit. And then a 1% increase to the private equity target from 5 to 6. Those changes would be sourced from a 2% reduction in public equity, a 1% reduction in public credit, which would likely come out of the EM debt allocation or sub-allocation, and then a 2% reduction in natural resources, which is our ag portfolio, which is naturally selling off over time. And then the two kind of, we'll spend a lot more time on this next month, but the two kind of combined asset class areas we're going to is we look at global equity as including EM anyway, so we would want to combine global and EM to one public equity asset class and treat the EM just like the rest of the strategies underneath the global equity, and then the combination of high yield bank loans and EM debt into a single public credit asset class. Leo, anything you want to add on kind of where we're going with this on the asset allocation?
It's been taking us 9 or 10 months to get here, so we evaluated tons of options. I would say the board staff, Makita, has been cognizant that private markets can add value, but it needs to be executed appropriately, and it needs to be done at the time that is appropriate for this fund. And for the past 7 or 8 years, it's been primarily playing defense and repositioning the portfolio. So right now, we're finally at a position where we can continue to play some defense, but begin to deploy some offense to try to generate stronger returns. I would expect to see a pretty constant line as opposed to those jumps like 05, 06, 08 in your chart of historical deployment, with consistency essentially dollar cost averaging into private market investment starting next year. So I think it's relatively minor changes, but in the right direction, so we're very supportive of it.
Is it Makita's opinion that increasing, adding more private equity would reduce the risk of the portfolio?
No, it would more or less maintain it, but it would be some kind of different risk. So you have some more blind pool risk coming in. You have much greater execution risk. So if you have more in public equities, you're going to have higher volatility. With private equity, the realized volatility, the observed, will be lower, but the inherent risk will be at least as high as would be with public equities. Now, with public equities, the dispersion of returns between the, you know, a better and a worse manager is going to be a few percentage points one way or the other. With private equity, you have seen it could be, you know, 20-30% gains on an yearly basis, or you can lose all your money. So that risk is much greater with private markets. So you got to go more carefully. Looks like there's a good plan that has been thought for a while, and I'm reassured by that.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so moving on to our private equity allocation. This is looking at, this is pre the sale out of Lone Star, but right now, as of end of August, we had $210 million in private equity, which is 10.3% of the portfolio. The current target is 5%. That's going to 6% once the board approves the asset allocation. We haven't made a new private market commitment or private equity commitment since 2006. When we look at what's in that Huff Energy Fund, there's one remaining asset that has acreage in the Eagle Ford Shale. It's largely proven undeveloped reserves, which is, you know, the valuation is very volatile. It would require a buyer to come in and spend a lot of money to develop out these proven reserves. It's very tied to E&P activity and oil pricing, and we don't expect it to move. Even though it's held within a private equity fund, we don't expect it to behave like traditional private equity. The other element is we have limited transparency from the GP, and this asset has been on the market for a number of years. Obviously, oil and gas markets have fluctuated, but we don't have a lot of confidence when we'll get a final liquidation out of this fund. So it could be next year, it could be 10 it was a year and a half ago. So it's in liquidation now.
Okay.
The fund term.
It's just the best effort sort of thing. It's not a distribute.
No. So so it could take a long time to sell. I think if we are waiting for Huff to liquidate to start making new private equity investments, that could be a very long time. Given even with the risk in private equity, it is prudent to start making some new investments into the private equity asset class. So that kind of outlines the issue we have. Staff and Makita, a lot of internal discussions to look at options on what to do about this issue. I think these are the four options we looked at. We were very conscious to avoid a whack-a-mole situation or just unintended consequences if we move something here and creates issues over here. The four options were moving Huff to its own asset class with a 0% target, moving Huff out of the asset allocation completely. It would still be part of the portfolio, but would it be measured as part of the asset allocation for rebalancing purposes, increasing the target allocation to private equity further up to account for the Huff asset, and then moving Huff to its own asset class with a 6% target. So our recommendation.
So Ryan, could I just interrupt?
Yeah.
When Ryan said we looked at these, they did a really deep dive into each of these. I just want you to know that. I mean, they prepared a lot of materials, and one of the things that I actually found most interesting is what that Ryan did was, the four-person investment team had these four options, and he allocated the option to the person who liked it least. They got the one they didn't like the most and had to defend it and kind of go through it. So they really had to dive into it. So it wasn't just we looked at them, considered them. There was a big analysis behind this. Just wanted to share that.
No, it was an interesting project because, you know, when we're talking about moving stuff around, we got to understand all the consequences of it. So our recommendation is to keep Huff within the broader equity asset allocation, but to move it to its own line item with a 0% target. So this is showing on the left side what it would look like now, and then on the right side what it would look like when we split Huff out if we do so. What that does is create some room in that private equity allocation to start making new investments. We think this is the best way to do it within the structure of the asset allocation that we're looking at now with investment policy, to show it's, you know, not true private equity, it's its own thing. You don't know when it's going to sell. The valuation swings wildly, sometimes year to year. And it allows us to look at the rest of the exposure within private equity and when we think that will liquidate, and then kind of control the new investments into that asset class as stuff liquidates out of the rest of the remaining private equity asset class. And this is actually shown, I believe, post the Huff sale, so we have a bit more room there. Any questions on the reclassification? Okay. So this is looking at what the asset allocation would look like when private credit and private equity would be fully funded, assuming no other liquidations from the real estate, ag, portfolio, or Huff. We just pro forma this with about 80% of the proceeds to fund the new private investments coming from public equity and 40% coming from public credit. What this does overall is it increases the private market portion of the portfolio because you're creating room and making new private investments. But overall, you'd see we could get up to about 29% private assets fully funded. Again, I think this is more of an extreme case where it assumes no distributions from the rest of the remaining private portfolio. And then also when we get to this point, which will be a few years down the road, hopefully we'll have an ADC in place and the monthly outflows for benefit payments will be less, so liquidity will be less of an issue. So at a high level, so like breaking it into its own line item allocation with a target of zero is the simplest way to kind of affect what we're trying to do here. It's consistent with what we did in 2018 when we had infrastructure and other asset classes that had no target in the new asset allocation. We report them against a zero target. Creates minimal disruption to reporting. It can be easily implemented through Makita's kind of current structure of the reporting. And then I think the trade-off is it's going to increase the liquidity of the portfolio by making new private equity investments, but we're comfortable with that. So I know it's a bit of a confusing concept, so I want to see if there's any questions or any further explanation I can provide. Simple. All right, so what we would do with this is, like I said, take the asset allocation and feedback that the board's okay with this concept back to the IC in 2 weeks, and then bring a final recommended asset allocation with the full asset allocation study to the board in October for approval. All right, moving on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice job on that.
Thank you.
All right, good morning. So we'll spend a few moments now looking at performance. This will be as of June 30th. We'll provide some verbal updates. I know Ryan mentioned earlier where you stand as of August 31st. So we'll start looking back 1 year. This is a snapshot looking at the last 12 months from June 30th. The fund return above its actuarial assumed rate with a 7.9, including public and private assets. I was behind policy. The underweight to equities, something that hurt, but also execution within private was also a headwind. And if you compare to peers, and here we define peers as other public pension funds nationally with size between 1 and 5 billion, it was behind by about 1.5 percentage points. In terms of how your public market managers perform, it was a mix. About half of them beat the benchmarks and half lagged. But collectively, they performed quite well versus, you know, a number of benchmarks and peers, producing a return of 13.5%. So essentially what you can control is performing on average quite well and has over the last number of cycles now. That portion has become larger and larger, so the net result is when you look at year comparison or comparison to your policy, you know, within the last 3 years, it's getting better. Longer date, it's weaker for the reasons Ryan mentioned earlier. And you're in compliance with all of your targets. We went through this chart already, so I won't repeat it. On the next page, page 101, let me provide some further perspective. When we first came on board, April or so of 2018, your illiquid assets were more than half. So in this case, what shows a 25% there and that reddish color would be more than half of this pie. And of that, a little bit more than half was branded as legacy assets. So there's been a lot of work to reduce that over time, as was discussed earlier today. The targets were set up several years ago to try to get us out of those assets into something more manageable, and we're getting close to that, and that's why now we are in the process of revisiting to find a more appropriate asset allocation. Again, not a lot of changes, but some on the margin, and those will be coming for you for approval at the next month. This was something that was requested. Oh, yes, Kristen.
Sorry, go back to, you talk about how big the peer universe is, the peer universe that you guys look at, because there have been some comments.
Yeah, it doesn't. Next time we'll improve the footnote and describe how many are. It changes from a period to another one, but it's not just, you know, four or five cities or municipalities in the state. It includes all of the public pension funds of that size that report to this master database. So it is, I don't have the exact number, but, you know, I'm guessing it's at least 50, 60.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So 56 different funds, around 56 different funds that are between $1 billion to $5 billion, the peer groups that we're comparing to.
Correct. Because if you were to compare to a fund that is $200 million in size, we'll be mostly invested in liquid assets. If you were looking at one that was, you know, 80 billion, it would be a very different entity operating. And so I think that range is very representative of, you know, peers with, you know, similar options to invest. They may have different objectives, right? They may have a target of 8%. They may be a different funded status. So they may not still be perfect apple to apple comparison, but it's as good as it gets.
Yes, so because that was brought up, our peer group was brought into question. So if you compare us to a pension in the state of Texas that isn't in this $1 to $5 billion area, it's really not an appropriate comparison. And so this is when you have over 50 funds in this area, it seems like a very appropriate benchmark.
Yeah, it depends. I think if it was $6 billion, I would argue, yeah, it's probably reasonably okay. The issue is just one, you know. Who determines one? I think if you determine everyone within a certain, you know, it's probably more more prudent. So this was something that was asked several years ago, and so we updated every quarter. It's good in the sense that it gives you a quick snapshot as to how your manager is doing, but it's very time dependent. Let's just say that Walter Scott had a very weak quarter. That may all of a sudden change the 3 and the 5 year into negative, but last quarter maybe they were all positive. So you may draw the conclusion that these guys are terrible if they've been lagging all the time. Well, they're lagging on this time period as of this point in which we're looking. It also doesn't tell you if you're lagging by 10 basis points or 500 basis points. So while it has some merits, now also it has some limitations. So we may look internally to see if there is a better way to report this in something that is also very simple, one-page snapshot for the fund. It also depends on the choice of benchmark. For example, Walter Scott, picking again on them, is a global equity manager with a growth bias, but not an aggressive growth manager. So if you were to compare them against more growth managers, they will lag, over this time period, if you were to compare more against core, they would do better. So it really, again, it depends on the choice of benchmarks. Sometimes there's multiple choices, sometimes one is the clear choice. Overall, over 3 years, you'll see most of your managers are doing fairly well. This is the second request that we add and track, and it's also been highlighted in recent conversations as the U.S. has been the dominant performer globally. You have an underweight to the U.S., not by design. The board did not set to underweight the U.S., but rather the board said to invest with global equity managers who the board views as competent and skilled in moving money around from Europe to the U.S. to emerging markets and back and across different sizes. And you can see that most of these managers have underallocated to the U.S. for a number of reasons. And they position the portfolio in other areas that are more attractive, mostly an evaluation perspective. So it's very easy to judge, you know, looking back, but, you know, managers position portfolios for what's going to happen tomorrow and not what happened, you know, in the past. But you see you have an underweight of about 10 percentage points to the U.S. versus a broad benchmark. And you are overweight about 7 points to other developed economies and 3 points to emerging market economies. So looking at performance, I think Ryan mentioned the 2.3% over the last 10 years and the reasons for that, very heavily impacted on the private markets arena. If you look at 3 years and lower, you know, returns are better both on absolute and relative performance. And I think Ryan mentioned the last 2 months have been quite strong. So bonds have gained probably 4% or so. Interest rates did come down. And then equities are up also another maybe 2 to 3 percentage points, depending on where you look. So your fund is up, you know, excluding private markets, that they may move up or down. Probably about 3 to 3.5%. So that brings you, you know, close to 8% year to date. Some quick attribution, and, you know, there's always some noise in short periods. Let's look at 1 year. Again, why did you lag by over 5 percentage points versus your policy benchmark? It's been execution within private markets. You have write-offs or write-downs. That has been the primary force, and when you look at longer periods, it's pretty much the same message. Looking at 3 years, and we look at a risk and return analysis, what risk was used to generate the return stream? You know, and by risk, we mean now standard deviation or volatility of returns, and we compare those to peers. Again, those $1 to $5 billion funds, you could count them. I don't know how many there are there, but I'm guessing 50. It's a good guess. You see that, you know, the fund has produced over the last 3 years a pretty respectable return versus peers, and with, you know, reasonable levels of variability of returns. If you think of a U.S. map, you would want to be in the northwest quadrant. Think of Seattle as opposed to Miami. So that means you have a higher return for a level of risk that is relatively low. And, you know, you're in that quadrant over the last 3 years. So the next couple of pages I'll go more quickly, and then I have one more chart that I want to show you, and then we'll take any questions you might have. But here we just look under the hood a little bit more. So we look at it by major asset classes, and you see global equity performing, you know, fairly well, quite in line with the benchmark. You know, over longer periods, outperforming the benchmark. If you scroll towards the middle of the page, then you have some of the fixed income metrics. Fixed income has performed quite well. Even in recent periods, you look at cash and short-term bonds over the last year, making 5.4%. So I recall when we had Nick the safety reserve, and we were wondering, you know, how much of a headwind is going to be. And yeah, there's an opportunity cost, but we knew there was a reason for those assets. Now that opportunity cost has been much more reduced. You know, you're making just 5% start with cash. The last page, I'm going to skip a few. Here is the allocation and how it's changed over time. So if you go back just 5 years, your public equity was a little over 25%. It was maybe 26, 27%. It's increased meaningfully since. And private equity has come down a little bit, but what's come down the most has been the realizations have come mostly from your real assets portfolio. The fixed income has also been reduced from time to time. So if essentially what we've been doing is moving more money into equities, and it's been the right time to do so. Had we been able to move it years ago, the returns would have been better. But again, we've been moving forward with an anchor, if you will, which is getting smaller and smaller every quarter, but it's freeing us up to make better decisions, and not better decisions, but to have more options in the future. I'll pause there. Any comments or questions?
I mean, just in general, are there any big trends relative to, you know, your funds that you're seeing, things you want to highlight? Have the staff been responsive to the IC, to suggestions, advice? Is there anything you all recommended that we've not done, or vice versa? I'm really just trying to draw some connection between your guys and your firm's competence and what we've done and executed on since we've been working together, and what conclusions or observations you draw.
Yeah. Communication has been always very transparent. This group is very solid. I think Kelly mentioned earlier, everything is posted on the website, everything is transparent, everything gets documented very well, whether it's a manager search or any decision. The work done, as you mentioned, Kelly, just on that reclassification of half was very impressive. It was, you know, 30 pages of different analysis that first staff did on the run, then they let us review it, come up with our own thoughts. We came up with some ideas, reviewed, provided feedback, ultimately arrived at a way to move forward and recommend to the board. So historically how we have worked together. So from that perspective, no issues and a very good collaboration, I would say. In terms of trends,
I think the discount rate.
Yeah, no.
Deloitte said that we're within the range of reasonable, but they really chose, for reasons I don't understand, to highlight that one point for us to revisit. Did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah. So the issue has been, with cash rates so high, you would expect on a go-forward basis, returns would be better. And that's why you saw those projections improve. And that's JP Morgan, that's one provider. There's 40 other groups that post information. Makita posts our own online, so anybody could have access. They could have used ours or any others or average all of the others. But ultimately, there's not such a great dispersion. So if you show 7.5, some others might show 7.7 or 7.3. So ultimately, the trend is one where over the last 2 years, future returns have improved versus the past, primarily because, you know, the starting point is higher. You know, that cash rate lifts all boats in the waterline. So there's been essentially no action by peers to adjust the assumed rate of return as a result of that. Why? Because they may as well come down very soon. And so if we were to be in an environment where, you know, a 5% cash rate is expected to remain for the next decade or two, then it may well be something to discuss, and you will see other practitioners do that over time. But I think there is some expectation that those rates will come down.
The futures already say they will.
Absolutely. But in general, to, you know, come down, maybe not to zero, but somewhere in between 2-3% as the long term. And in that scenario, I think your rate is sound. I also think the comment made earlier by Kelly, you know, you want to be within range, but with all that happened, it's much better to be conservative. And so it's not typically Makita's role or the investment consultant to set that, but we are reassured and pleased that, you know, we're leaning on the conservative side and not on the aggressive. And so if we produce return of 8%, we have an actuarial gain that benefits us. And so ultimately, we need not lose focus that this is not a one-year patch or solution. This is a very long-term game. We're talking decades. And so I think the changes that have taken place the last few years are setting the stage for good performance in the future. But to see those changes in your funded status and other metrics will take time.
And so, once again, saying we own our track record.
Yeah.
We are DPFP, and we're not hiding from it or running it. It is what it is. But given the commitments that are already in place and private assets and all the contractual lockups and inability to control your destiny with your capital versus in public markets where you can make a decision to sell away, have there been any decisions we've done or not done that you said, like, hey, that, you know, you guys didn't turn right and you should have, or turned left or whatever, or you feel like we followed a relatively prudent path given the limitations that we have?
No, you followed the prudent path. I think probably the most important decision goes back to 2017, 2018, and you had, you know, that big chunk of illiquid assets. You were able to sell in the secondary market at, I would call it, a reasonable price. Of course, you took some discounts, you know, a bunch of assets. The rest had either no market or steep discounts, and maybe at the time you didn't need that because you already had enough liquidity by selling those. In retrospect, one could say, oh, if you had sold them, the market, but you would have not known how you would have deployed that money. There was really no market at the time, and the discounts were so big that, you know, and there was a concerted effort, and there were resources dedicated to try to recoup every cent and every dollar in those investments. And you saw the charts earlier. So I think that was probably the most, one of the things that had the most important, and that set the stage for the next 7 years. It was, you know, many years to then work around and try to recoup everything, or sell at a big discount and then try to make lots of gains on that smaller pool to grow it back and recoup those losses. You know, it's very difficult to say how those investments would have performed, how they would have invested, and what would have happened.
But within the public portfolio, have we not followed any of your advice or suggestions in allocation or manager selection or things like that?
No, I mean, whenever we had ideas, we brought those up to staff. Those came then to the board. The public markets portfolio has performed fairly well. There has been no issues. The fixed income has been very, very strong. And the global equity, if you were to compare to many others, it's done well. The main headwind has been under allocation to, you know, the Magnificent Seven stocks, which is quite common. Unless you were fully indexed, you most likely lack, because most managers are underexposed there.
Yeah, you know, what you just said, actually, Commerce Street agreed with one of their slides right here that says DPFP has performed adequately in its public market equity and its income, but it's lagged in its private market investment. So you and Commerce Street are on the same piece, the same page on that particular point. And then they also said DPFP has performed competitively in its public equity portfolio compared to Texas peers. So once again, it's Commerce Street, and it seems like on this point you would agree with what they said. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Brian, anything else?
No, that's it for the investment.
We really appreciate Makita. You guys are great business partners. Appreciate all the role that you play, and you know, we look forward to continuing our relationship with you guys. So thank you. Thank you for coming here today.
For the support, we'll see you next month.
You can do the next item. We have a closed language.
I'll go ahead. Next item is the hardship request.
John, can you go to page 160? So this is way back in your PDF if you're looking for it, page 160. So we can talk about this hardship request because I'm not going to give you any information that would disclose who this person is. So the board allows hardships for from people's drop annuities, and it's the board has adopted a policy, and it's a rigorous policy. It's, you know, we require that people basically show us all their financial information, which is, you know, difficult for them as well as us. And we go through it, and we have to decide, do they have the financial means to take care of the hardship that they're asking for? And if we determine that they don't, then we need to decide, does the hardship situation meet the criteria that's laid out in the statute and in the policy? So we have a hardship request from a person that has a drop annuity, and also the board has delegated to the executive director the ability to approve any hardship request, but I do not have the ability to deny one. So if I want to deny a hardship request, either in total or part of it, that's when you all get involved. So for this particular one, we received a request to, for a hardship of $25,000, and they want to gross it up by 20% to pay the taxes on that. The monthly drop annuity for this person is $466, and they'll get that until 2046. We went through the process and determined that on a monthly basis, they have about $1,377 of free money, but they didn't provide all of the financial information that we asked for. But it looks like they have some money, but not enough to cover everything that they're asking for. Their only net worth is really tied up in their primary property, their primary residence, with what they provided to us. So we came to the conclusion that the person doesn't have the financial ability to cover this $25,000 worth of needs. My recommendation to you is that we deny a part of this and approve part of it. So they've asked for about $2,000 related to repairs of the HVAC. My recommendation is to deny that request because one of the criteria, this is actually in the plan, is that the hardship cannot be foreseeable. And anybody that owns a house knows that it is foreseeable that you're going to need to repair things. The board in the past has denied other requests related to similar situations on mechanical equipment related to a home. The other item is related to down trees. The letter they submitted says down trees on one of their properties. They only provided us information that they had a primary residence and didn't give us information on any other properties. I've left two messages for this person. She hasn't called me back. So I don't know where the down trees are. I looked on Google Earth. There are no trees on this person's property. So the trees, from what I can tell, are not related to the primary residence based on Google Earth and also her letter. So I would deny that. The other part relates to significant dental work. We have one estimate for $12,000 for the dental work, and then the second estimate we had, the increase went up by about $10,000. I don't believe this person has the ability to pay for the dental work, and I don't believe because of a recent bankruptcy that they can get financing for it. So I would recommend approving the dental work and paying the person after they provide us with an EOB, explanation of benefits, from their insurance company showing what their share of the dental work was. So that's my recommendation. Any questions?
Okay. So, if not, can we have a motion to approve the hardship distribution related to the dental procedures on receipt of the explanation of benefits from the insurance company indicating the actual not estimated uninsured portion of the cost and to deny the other portions of the hardship request? Do the motion. Second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you. Next item during closed session, would you like to handle the briefing items?
Yeah, why don't we do, so we'll do D2 and then go back to 14. Okay.
The executive director report is the same as every month. You have your NCPERS monitor newsletter, and as far as open records requests, we've received one since the last meeting. It was a general request from a source that just compiled investment information. So nothing unusual there. That's it.
Okay. So, Josh, we're going to close session now? Okay. John?